Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It wasn't me. It was my brain. David Cruz in for Brian Lehr on WNYC. And today, the final installment of our Ask a Bioethicist series. We're calling it Blame It on the Brain. Nita Farahani, Duke University bioethicist, is here, as she's been with us every week this month. Welcome back, Nita.
Thanks. It's great to be back with you.
Listeners, did you hear that one of the teenagers convicted in the Steubenville rape case plans to appeal the verdict, claiming that his 16-year-old brain wasn't developed enough to be held fully responsible for his behavior? We can scoff at that as an extreme example, but it is true that the prefrontal cortex of an adolescent brain is very different than that of a 30-year-old. How should we decide whether a teenager should be held fully responsible for their actions? 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. Nita, so Malik Richmond is one of those teenagers convicted of the Steubenville rape. His lawyer is going to appeal specifically the requirement that his client register as a sex offender for the rest of his life. And his argument is that a 16-year-old brain isn't fully functional. Can you explain the kind of science that he's referring to?
Sure. So this has actually come up in quite a few criminal cases recently, which is this what I call the developing brain theory. So we've known, and I mean, surely every parent who has a child knows that children's brains develop over time and that as a result, it takes a long time before they can do things like exercise good judgment or control their impulses or, do things according to social norms. And we can understand that in part because of the developing brain, which is it takes a while for the brain to become fully myelinated. It also takes a while for the frontal lobe region of the brain, which is important for executive decision making and for controlling impulses, to be fully developed. So in quite a few criminal cases, juveniles have come in and said, hey, you can't blame me for not following social norms because my brain made me do it. I wasn't fully able to control my impulses. I wasn't able to exercise good judgment. And it's gained some traction in a few major Supreme Court cases that have dealt with questions of should juveniles be subject to the death penalty or should juveniles be subject to life without the possibility of parole. And the Supreme Court, citing to developing neuroscience, has said twice now already and a third time in part that the developing brain theory matters for whether or not we treat juveniles the same way as we treat adults in the criminal system.
Listeners, what about other behaviors that might be rooted in abnormal brain development? What if your amygdala is faulty, which is the so-called violence inhibition mechanism in your brain? Should you be punished more or less harshly? What if your brain chemistry causes you to be addicted to food or drugs? Should society judge you less for being obese or being a drug addict? Call us up if you want to discuss or ask an ethical question of Nita Farahani. The number is 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. Nita, there are different legal rules for juveniles and adults. Teenagers are prone to take more stupid risks. That's why we at least theoretically don't try kids as adults when they commit crimes. They face lighter punishments. Is there a substantive biological difference that would suggest that juveniles are less in control than adults?
Certainly, there's good science to suggest that juveniles are less in control than adults. But I think the question that this case, as well as other cases, presents is a little bit more complicated than that. So obviously, we know that everybody's brain differs a little bit, and we can look at the brain and see differences across the population, which helps to explain some of the reasons why people do dumb things, violent things, antisocial things. But does that mean that when somebody commits a horrific act of rape, that we should say, that person's brain made them do it? Well, of course their brain made them do it. Your brain makes you do everything. But do we really want to say as a society that that a juvenile can't exercise judgment to know that a person is drunk, is unable to consent, that when they say no, no means no? And I think the answer to that is clearly not, that we recognize that juveniles still are capable of knowing the difference between right and wrong. How we punish them is a different question. And I think what the lawyers in this case are trying to do is say, look, even if you hold my client responsible, the question is this punishment, which is register as a sex offender for the rest of your life, is that punishment appropriate for a juvenile whose brain will change, who we can expect will be a different person 5 years from now, 10 years from now, 20 years from now, than the adult with the fully developed brain?
So what do we make of an adult whose brain isn't quite normal, for lack of a better word? There's a distinct biological difference between a psychopath and a regular person, right? Do we judge a psychopath who commits a crime less harshly?
Well, there are certainly people who argue it. So there are people who are studying psychopaths and saying, look, we can see that psychopaths lack the same moral conscience that the average person in society does, and therefore morally blaming them or holding them criminally responsible seems wrong. I think that doesn't make a lot of sense. I think the questions of whether or not we hold a person responsible, we can't look into the brain to answer that question. That's a question for society to answer, which is, you know, given that some people are going to be better at following the law and some people are going to have a harder time following the law, do we nevertheless think that everybody should be incentivized to follow the law?
Right.
And do we nevertheless think that when somebody commits a horrific crime against an individual in society, that we should hold that person responsible and punish them accordingly?
Let's try and get a call in here. Eli is in Brooklyn. Eli, welcome to the show.
Good morning. I feel that if it was the bad decisions are due to the fact that that portion of the brain is not developed, then no 16-year-old would be making the right decisions because they're not developed. And yet you have some teenagers that make excellent, educated, the right decision, and those that don't. So, I don't think it can apply to all of them.
I think, Eli, you make a really good point, which is we can see that brain abnormalities, you know, that there's variation across the population, and yet every juvenile has a developing brain, and many of them exercise good judgment. And the same with the my brain made me do it defense across the criminal justice system. When a criminal defendant comes into the courtroom and says, look, I've got this region of my brain that's damaged or this region of my brain that isn't developed as the next person, lots of people with those same abnormalities nevertheless actually act according to law. So what we can understand is there's no such thing as my brain made me do it in the way that people are trying to argue it. Instead, it's one influence on a person's decision making. And that isn't determinative. There are other reasons that a person acts. And clearly, there are bad reasons that a person acts. In this case, we know that they knew that the girl was drunk, that she was unable to consent, and they knew the difference between right and wrong, and they went ahead and did it anyway.
Yeah. We learn more and more about the brain all the time, and the more we learn about the brain, the more we see connections between behavior and brain chemistry. So do you think that the legal and ethical questions get murkier because science will increasingly be able to tell us what part of our brain biology is to blame?
So I'd put it a little bit differently, which is I think that the more we learn about the brain, the more we may learn that the way in which we punish people doesn't achieve what we want to achieve. So if the idea is to reduce crime in society, to increase deterrence, to get people to be better citizens in society, is incarceration the way that we do that? Is harsh criminal punishments the way that we do that? Or are treatment modalities or rehabilitation a better way to do it? So I think the more we learn about the brain, the more we can question whether or not we have the most effective criminal justice system. But it doesn't change whether or not we as a society think we should hold people responsible for their actions. And of course, this applies outside of the criminal justice system. You know, an adulterer says, you know, I'm sorry, I couldn't resist, you know, sleeping with this other person because my brain made me do it. I was overwhelmingly attracted to this person. Or, you know, I can't help eating sugar because I'm addicted to it. Or I can't help smoking cigarettes because I'm addicted to nicotine. And, you know, the question is, to what extent do we really believe that we're powerless to change our behavior in life?
Well, what about addiction? Can you explain a little bit the science of addiction? Is it possible that a person is born with a biological predisposition to become addicted to something?
Absolutely. So we know already from science, and it's still in its infancy, but we already know from both genetics and neuroscience that people can be predisposed to become addicted, which means that those people who have a higher likelihood of becoming addicts, when they take their first drink or when they smoke their first cigarette, they're much more likely to become addicts than the next person, the person who doesn't have those genetic or neurological abnormalities. So it's harder for them to break the habit, and it's more likely for them that they'll become addicted when they try it for the first time. And you could say, well, then we can't blame the person. Or you could say that then we need to actually figure out people who are predisposed, inform them of that, and give them the opportunity to avoid taking the first drink or avoid smoking the first cigarette.
So if we know that body chemistry impacts whether people can't control how much they eat as easily as other people, that could impact policy, right? I mean, Mayor Bloomberg's soda ban, for example, was criticized for infringing on personal freedoms. But if we know that people don't have as much control over their own behavior, isn't it the role of government, or is it the role of government, to limit our choices for our own good?
Well, that's a paternalistic policy, right? Which is to say, if people have a hard time doing things, then the government should step in and save them from themselves. I think there's a different approach that you might take that I would probably take, which is empower people to make better choices. So, you know, I'd want people to know about their genetic and neurological predispositions. I'll tell you a little anecdote. There was a university, I won't name them because they ended up avoiding this major ethical conundrum, but there was a university that sent out, as part of their welcome kit to incoming freshmen, they sent them a little cotton swab and invited them to give a saliva sample so that they could genotype each incoming freshman. And they wanted to do it based on a few lifestyle genes that we have some information about, like your predisposition to become obese or your predisposition to addiction, so that they could then tell the incoming freshmen that and track them over 4 years and see whether or not telling an incoming freshman that they're likely to become an addict if they drink, or likely to put on that freshman 15 if they spend too much time at the eating hall, that they would change their behavior. And they didn't really follow the ethical guidelines to do human subjects research, so that program was shut down. But it's an interesting thought, which is, if we empower people with information that they're likely to put on the freshman 15, they're likely to become addicted to drugs or alcohol if they start down that path, is that enough to have them avoid the behavior to begin with? And if we found out that actually, no, there's no way that you could avoid it, then maybe you would think that it's the role of government to actually step in at that point because people are powerless to do otherwise.
So we can't do that with cigarettes, though, don't we? I mean, banning cigarettes in bars and stuff? Or is that's kind of a different question? It's more about the health of the people who work there, right?
Yeah, and I think that's reasonable, which is once a person's actions start to harm another person, that society or government should step in to prevent them from doing so. So secondhand cigarette smoke, we know, has, you know, serious dangerous effects for other people. I think it's appropriate then for the government to step in.
All right. Nida Farahani is professor of law and philosophy and professor of genome sciences and policy at Duke University. She also sits on the presidential committee to study for the study of bioethical issues. Thank you so much for doing this series, Nida.
I've really enjoyed it. Thanks for having me.
Nice talking to you. Up next, an hour of marriage and family. Should alimony rules be changed? Should same-sex marriage rules be changed? And food, the best part of a family gathering. I'm David Cruz, in for Brian Lehrer. Stay with us.